Alrighty folks, and welcome to the Chronicler Podcast Channel, Episode 24, Hanwoo Dee. Like I said in my last podcast, Hanwoo Dee deserves an episode on his own. Now we have a lot to cover, so I hope you are ready for this incredible story about an emperor who seemed rather useless at the beginning of his career to being the undisputed ruler of the dynasty. Liu Chua, also known as Emperor Wu, became the longest lasting emperor in Chinese history up until the Qing dynasty over 1000 years later. Hanwoo Dee made many groundbreaking reforms and really took the Han dynasty and China to new heights in terms of territorial expansion, influence and culture. In today's episode, we will begin with Emperor Wu's early reign, which was extremely difficult, then move on to the reforms he made and then finish it off with his territorial expansion and what he left behind. Now before I go on, I would like to say, if you enjoy the show, please be sure to share it with your friends, please be sure to go onto the Facebook page and follow whenever I release a new episode. It would really help the channel out and I would really appreciate it. Thank you. But for now, on with the story. So Liu Chua was born on the 30th of July, 157 BC, and was the crown prince of the Han dynasty. He was destined to be the seventh emperor of the Han. Now some sources say that whilst his mother was pregnant, she could see the sun entering her belly, which was a really auspicious sign. A truly auspicious sign. Liu Chua's father died when he was very young, only 15 years old, and it was in the year 141 BC that he became the new emperor of the Han dynasty. Liu Chua, now Emperor Wu, had a few obstacles to his rule when he became emperor. The first was his grandmother, Grand Empress Dowager Dou. The Grand Empress had lots of friends and nobles who had basically began to live extremely comfortable lives in the capital, happily taking bribes and ignore the calls of the people. Emperor Wu wanted to change this, but he soon quickly realised that his gran held real political power over the Han court, and any mention of reform was simply blocked through one legal loophole or another. Emperor Wu tried to propose reforms known as the Jian Yuan reforms. The reforms had five main goals. The first was officially endorsing Confucianism as the national philosophy. Previously, people were more into Taoism or legalism at the time, and Confucianism was kind of in the background. Even though Liu Bang tried to institutionalise a little bit, it's just more, it didn't really get imperial backing as such. The second was forcing noblemen back to their fiefdoms. Now a large number of noblemen, like I said, were living in the Chinese capital, Chang'an, lobbying court officials whilst exploiting the central government's budget to cover their expenses, despite already having gained great wealth from their own feudal land. Emperor Wu's new policy dictated that they could no longer live off the government spending and just leave the capital if lacking any justifiable reason to keep staying. The third was the removal of non-central government sanctioned checkpoints. Again, many lords or vassal states had established checkpoints along main stage roads that went through their territory with the purpose of collecting tolls and restricting traffic. Emperor Wu wanted to seize control of transportation from local authorities and return that control back to the central government. The fourth reform was encouraging the reporting and prosecution of criminal activities by nobles. Noblemen engaged in illegal activities a lot, and basically they could get away with it, and they thought they were above the law. Hanwoo Dee wanted to change this. And the fifth rule, or the fifth law that he proposed, was the recruitment and promotion of talented commoners into government positions, in order to reduce the administrative monopoly by the noble classes. However, despite the need for reform, he met fierce resistance from his gran. Bloody old people. They always get in the way of change, right? Not to worry. Emperor Wu played it cool and took the advice of his mother, who basically said, "She'll be dead soon, bide your time." Which he did. He pretended to not be interested in government, and went out hunting and partying frequently, and this suited the conservative elements in the Han court just fine. What nobody knew, however, was that Han Wu-Di then went on to form a secret council of members that reported to the emperor directly everything that went on in the Han court. This was both in public and behind closed doors. Chinese court culture, very much like the Roman Senate, was full of political intrigue, and Emperor Wu wanted to know everything that was going on. The people he employed for these jobs would be known as the Emperor's Inner Circle, and the scheme was rather ingenious. The people who the Emperor employed were usually peasants or were very low rank. From there, he would promote them to low-tasking jobs, with the promise of high court positions in the future, based on their deeds to help the Emperor. From here, the servants could spy on the nobles from right under their noses and report back to the Emperor directly. By employing people of low rank with the promises of high court positions later on, ensured Emperor Wu's subordinates, or spies, would be fiercely loyal to him, and him alone. Emperor Wu's mother proved to be right when she told the young emperor to bide his time, as by 135 BC, his grandmother passed away, and with that, any opposition to reforms. Immediately, Han Wu-Di expelled the nobles who he knew were against him, and replaced them with the young and talented insider court he'd been preparing for years. Then, to add insult to injury to those nobles who had defied him, Emperor Wu sanctioned that all nobles and vassals had to divide their realms between their sons equally after they died. This made it so much easier for Emperor Wu to simply divide and conquer those who remained, thus increasing his power and completing the process of centralising power to the emperor and imperial court. Emperor Wu's next issue was not a political or military one, but a cultural one. Han Wu-Di faced the same problem as his ancestors. How should the empire be run? Should it be run through fear and at the point of a sword? Or should it be run with moral integrity? Emperor Wu decided to go with the latter, and openly demonised the legalism, as the Qin had failed to control their state with that philosophy, and it was much hated anyway, and he openly embraced Confucianism. Now you're probably thinking, so what he embraced in Confucianism? What's the big deal? The fact is, it was a huge deal. Confucianism became the closest thing to what the Bible or the Quran is to Christians and Muslims. And speaking of Christians, Christianity only became the dominant religion in the Roman Empire through Emperor Constantine. So in this regard, Emperor Constantine of Rome and Emperor Wu of China are comparable. Any legalists who were in any government position were swiftly kicked out under Emperor Wu and replaced with Confucian ones. Confucianism became the state philosophy under Han Wu-Di, and China's cultural problems were for the most part solved. Han Wu-Di did take it a step further though, and in order to get a job in government, one had to be able to read, recite and remember the Confucian classics in an exam. This included the Spring and Autumn Annals, the classics of poetry, the writings of Mencius, a student of Confucius, and many, many more. One had to display a level of competency in these exams if they had any hope of getting a governmental job. This system was called the Imperial Examination System, and this practice even lasted after the Han Dynasty ended, and it was later emulated by other Chinese dynasties in the future. The Imperial Examination System ensured that individuals would get jobs in the government because they were actually good at their job, and not through royal family ties, which was pretty much the norm before then. The last and final part of Han Wu-Di's legacy was his military campaigns and the territorial expansion of the Han Dynasty under his reign. Emperor Wu decided to strike at China's troublesome neighbours to the north, the Xiongnu. The Xiongnu, if you remember, had been accepting bribes of Chinese silk, gold, and even princesses in order to not invade Han China. All of that was about to change, as Emperor Wu had decided enough was enough and prepared for war. The major issue the Emperor faced, however, was that war was expensive and was a huge drain on the economy. In order to compensate for this, Emperor Wu decided to nationalise salt and iron production, the two most profitable resources within the empire. Furthermore, he standardised the prices of grain and ensured that the minting of coins was also standardised and run by the state. Through these reforms, which were somewhat unpopular, Emperor Wu was able to field multiple armies in the hundreds of thousands at a time. Now he had an army he could throw at the Xiongnu. By 133 BC, Wu Di officially ended paying tribes to the Xiongnu and launched the first of many, many campaigns to the north. These campaigns lasted between 127 and 119 BC. The campaigns were brutal, intense, and cost hundreds of thousands of lives both on the Han side and on the Xiongnu side. However, Han tactics under generals Wei Qin and Huo Chubing proved to be decisive. The Xiongnu cavalry in many ways were superior to that of the Han. So to compensate for this, the Han invested in crossbows and halberd infantry initially. However, they were inevitably too slow. The idea was that the Han could basically steer the Xiongnu cavalry into traps where they couldn't escape and their manoeuvrability would be obsolete. And with that, the spear infantry would do their work and cut them down. Any riders who did manage to escape that scene of carnage would then be chased down by the Han forces' cavalry. However, this didn't really work. So a new solution was put into place. Basically, become exactly like the Xiongnu in order to defeat them, which actually worked. For example, the Xiongnu were masters of hit-and-run tactics. They would launch a huge raid, kill as many as possible, loot as much as possible, then run away. The Han infantry couldn't even begin to dream of keeping up with them. But now, the times had changed. And if when the Xiongnu began to disperse, the Han forces began to race after them with their cavalry and cut down the Xiongnu leading units in order to confuse the enemy and then hunt down the rest. These kinds of tactics proved decisive, and very soon it was the Xiongnu who would suffer defeat after defeat at the hands of the Han forces. Generals Wei Qin and Huo Chubing launched devastating raids into Xiongnu territory and took over the land. The most famous of these battles was the Battle of Mobei in 119 BC, where Han forces slaughtered over 90,000 Xiongnu troops and forced the nomads north into the Gobi Desert. It was here that the Han dynasty would expand northward and to the west, creating a safe passage for merchants on the newly created, or newly recognised, Silk Road. This became known as the He Xi Corridor. The Silk Road opened up lots of commercial opportunities to the Han dynasty, and of course to the Romans in the west. This corridor and trade route connected the two empires, even though it was an unofficial way, which I will discuss with the podcaster Death to the Roman Republic next week, and it will be on next week's episode. Furthermore, the Silk Road will get its own episode, I think, as it includes an incredible journey westward by one of the Emperor's subordinates. But more on that later. Back to the conquests of Emperor Wu. After dealing with the Xiongnu and securing his northern flank, Han Wu Di focused on the south. The south became rather volatile at the perfect time for Han Wu Di. The north had been crushed, and it was at this moment, when the Han forces were free, that the south had tried to be troublesome in 138 BC. Now I'm going to oversimplify this, as the relations between the north and south were rather complicated. But what you need to know is that what is today's southern China, provinces like Chongqing, Guangdong, Guangxi, Hainan, Yunnan and Fujian, were not under Han rule at the time. The southerners, also known as the Bayu, meaning 100 tribes, seen their northern neighbours as foreigners, and generally wanted to be left alone. The problem, however, was that some Han peoples had moved south and assimilated into the local cultures, and sometimes became leaders, and then became vassal kingdoms of the Han Empire. As well as that, the southern tribes, they were more likely to fight each other than the Han dynasty, which was all fine and well for the Han. However, one such conflict between the Ming Yue to the east and the Nan Yue to the south saw the latter offering to become a vassal of the Han Empire. Once the danger was over, however, the relationship would quickly fall apart as the native prime minister of the Nan Yue, Lu Jia, killed his pro-Han king Jiao Xin and led a rebellion against the Han. Han Wudi, furious with this sign of disloyalty, sent an army of 300,000 men and crushed the Nan Yue into submission. This show of brute force meant that the southern tribes soon after all submitted to the authority of the imperial court. The south did well for Han Wudi, as now he had access to more tropical climates, which in turn meant more goods, such as elephant tusks, peacocks, and pearls that could be used by the Han aristocracy. What's more, though, is that the coastline in the south acted as a great hub for trading with places further away. As well as this, the conquest of the southern provinces allowed Han Wudi to completely assimilate Han culture into the south, and ensured Han culture dominated the region. He did this through rather brutal tactics, though. He split the Nan Yue into 9 provinces, all with Han officials ruling over them. And in the Ming Yue, because of the terrain and the mountains, he moved the population out of the region and then into the Chinese heartlands, ensuring the people would be brought into Han culture. If Han Wudi didn't do this, perhaps the south's languages and peoples and cultures would be a little more diverse than it is today. Next in the territorial conquest came to what is now North Korea in 109 BC. A breakdown in relations where the kingdom of, please forgive me if I pronounce this wrong, Joseon? We'll go with Joseon. Like, I really don't know Korean, I'm really sorry if I've pronounced that terribly, but I think it's Joseon, executed a Han envoy. So the kingdom of the Han dynasty, they went to North Korea with an envoy to try and work a deal out, and then the king, also known as Yujio, killed the messenger. Now, of course, if you're going to kill the messenger, be sure to actually be able to back yourself up with an army when war inevitably hits you in the face. King Lujo of the Gojiseong, however, didn't do that. And when the enraged Han Wudi led a massive army against the Koreans, it was an easy win, and the Han Empire annexed the northern tip of the Korean Peninsula. This started a long tradition of Chinese domination over the peninsula as well. And that's that. Han Wudi managed to accomplish such an astronomical achievement for his time. He managed to almost double the size of his empire. He managed to secure his power by centralizing the Han regime, and he also answered the cultural questions the empire was asking of itself. Han Wudi managed to achieve all of this in one lifetime. In China, he is by far one of the most famous emperors ever, and is certainly the most famous of the Han dynasty. However, modern day scholars have put a shade of doubt over Han Wudi. Was he really a great figure who was a fatherhead of Chinese culture and Confucianism? Or was he just, as some have suggested, a cruel conqueror who led the destruction of many different cultures and ways of life? Let me know what you think, and thanks for listening. See you next time.